You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Vanity Fair magazine. This is a combined issue for December of 2022 and January of 2023. And this is Vanity Fair, Part A. Here's the continuation of Hall of Fame by Michael Rydell, with photos by Sebastian Kim. Over the years, several Broadway producers had approached Crow about turning Almost Famous into a musical. It is, after all, a movie about falling in love with music, and its soundtrack, including Simon and Garfunkel's America, Joni Mitchell's River, Lynyrd Skynyrd's Simple Man, The Beach Boys' Feel Flows, Clarence Carter's Slip Away, Todd Rundgren's It Wouldn't Have Made Any Difference, and Elton John's Tiny Dancer, has the makings of a hit jukebox musical. The kind of show in which old hits are shoehorned into a plot. The audience has plenty to drink, they sing and dance, go home happy, and the cash register rings. Crow turned down all the offers. Almost Famous was too personal. He couldn't see it as a musical, especially a jukebox musical. Leah Volak, then the head of Sony's music and theater departments, and British director Jeremy Herron, who had staged the theatrical adaptation of Hilary Mantel's Wolf Hall, convinced him otherwise. Volak, who began her career at 16 as a roadie for Johnny Thunders and the Ramones, was mining Sony's catalog of famous movies, looking for something that might have stage potential. She gave Herron a list of 700 titles. Herron's first choice was Almost Famous. When he told Volak, she had a kind of quirky response, Herron said. She twitched and said, "That's funny, because I'm trying to persuade Cameron to turn it into a show. This is a very good sign." Crow still resisted until Herron forced the issue. He flew from New York to Los Angeles and asked for a meeting with Crow. "I'm a big rock fan," said Herron, adding that Almost Famous was good territory for me as a director. I could really plug into my obsession with rock and roll. I wasn't pitching ideas. I just turned up with a genuine passion. I think anything else would have stank of bullshit." Herron and Volak emphasized that what they liked most about the movie was its intensely personal nature. The one thing they did not want, they said, was a carbon copy of the movie, and they rejected the idea of a jukebox musical. It seemed too cheap and easy. Yes, they'd use some of the famous songs from the soundtrack. Tiny Dancer had to be there, of course. But to deepen the emotional impact of the story, they wanted an original score. "The thing they'd tell me all the time is that in the theater there are no close-ups. You know there are no close-ups, right?" And I was like, "I know there are no close-ups," Crow recalled. "In the theater," Herron told him, "the close-ups are called songs." It was a tall order to blend new theater songs with Led Zeppelin and have it all feel like it's of the same world, Volak said. "We wanted to have our cake and eat it, too." They briefly considered Elton John to write new songs, but scheduling issues made that impossible. Volak then turned to Tom Kitt, who had won the Pulitzer Prize in 2010 for the musical Next to Normal. In addition to composing, Kitt, 48, is one of Broadway's most sought-after arrangers and orchestrators, and he knows his way around rock music. He orchestrated Green Day's American Idiot and Alanis Morissette's Jagged Little Pill for Broadway. Kitt leapt at the chance to work with Crow. Almost Famous was one of his favorite movies. "Every Cameron Crowe movie for me was an event," he said. Growing up in Bedford, New York, Kitt had aspired to be a singer-songwriter in the mode of Billy Joel, Elton John, and James Taylor. He discovered the power of a well-crafted, intimate rock ballad when he entered a high school Battle of the Bands competition. He didn't belong to a band, so he performed Joel's signature Piano Man, accompanying himself on the piano and harmonica. The band before him was so loud, the whole place clears, he recounted. So I'm playing to an empty gym, and I'm not looking up. About midway through, I look up, and it is standing room packed. And the rest of my set was just me and my guitarist friend, and we tied for the win. They weren't sure if I qualified as a real band. Kit and Crow wrote much of the score to Almost Famous on weekends in a room on the 28th floor of the Sony building in New York City. The room is red, with a wraparound photograph of the classical pianist Glenn Gould. Crow would write memos outlining scenes, relationships, and key moments in the story, and then Kit, sitting at a grand piano, would fashion the memos into songs. Crow is credited as co-lyricist, but any suggestion that he's in league with Oscar Hammerstein II, Larry Hart, or Stephen Sondheim makes him blanch. I'm just happy to shovel coal into the furnace and let Kit cook, he says. Prodded by Volak, Heron, and Kit, Crow dug deeper into the family dynamic. As a teenager, he was pulled between his strict mother and his rebellious older sister Cindy, who left home to become a flight attendant. You left home at 15 to write about Led Zeppelin, his mother once said to him. Your sister went off to be a stewardess. Was I not fun? She wasn't aware that her dogma was not fun, generally, Crow said. It could be. I thought it was a little more fun than maybe my sister did. The tension between mother and daughter is funny in the movie, but in reality it wasn't a cute rebellion, Crow said. To survive, she had to leave the family. It was kind of a life-or-death move, and the fact that it's not cute in the musical makes the whole story deeper. My mother and I had a very complicated relationship, Cindy wrote in an email. Music and travel became a refuge for me. The unbreakable bond I had with my brother was our lifelong passion for music. The play and its music have done much healing for our family. Kit and Crow's challenge was to fit their new songs snugly next to the classics. They did not want the narrative to grind to a halt every time an old favorite jumped out of the score. Judging from the reviews in San Diego, they've succeeded. While plenty of pop culture's greatest hits have been turned into jukebox musicals, Almost Famous is not one of them, Variety wrote. The majority of the music consists of 20 original numbers. The end result? A backstage pass to peek into a world that feels fantastical and real. In the Los Angeles Times, Charles McNulty noted, seamlessly incorporated into the score are carefully chosen hits from the period, including a mesmerizing rendition of Tiny Dancer and a haunting rendition of Joni Mitchell's River. Kit's arrangements artfully weave these vintage treasures into an enchanting tapestry of sound. We're lucky enough that Joni Mitchell gave us River, and that's tucked into a Tom Kitt song called Lost in New York City, Crow said. The two do a little dance together. That's my favorite music moment in the show. Another favorite is Morocco, sung by Penny Lane. It's a plaintive, tender, early 70s-style ballad inspired by his mother's favorite song, Barcelona. To play Alice's role, Elaine, the creative team cast Anika Larsson, a veteran of 5 Broadway musicals, including Beautiful, the Carole King musical, in which she delivered a delightfully funny turn as King's close friend, songwriter Cynthia Wheel. Larsson had never seen Almost Famous when she got the call, but as soon as her agent told her she was up for the Frances McDormand part, she said, "Oh, done. She's my favorite actor of all time. I will do a musicalized version of any role Frances McDormand has ever played." She watched the movie a few days before the first pre-pandemic reading of Almost Famous back in 2018. She loved the script and was thrilled to discover she had three great songs. But she was off her game during the run-throughs. I didn't feel comfortable reading the lines. And then I realized I'm trapped in Frances McDormand's performance. Larson battled it out, and with the help of director Heron, eventually created her own Elaine. She won't watch the movie again until the day I leave the show. So Leah Pfeiffer, making her Broadway debut at 28, she toured in Hamilton, is also steering clear of the movie while she's in the musical. She's up against Kate Hudson's portrayal of Penny Lane. I have adopted this attitude of when you are tackling something iconic, she said, just by virtue of being yourself within it, you are already taking ownership. It helps, she added, that I am 10 feet taller than Kate Hudson, and I'm not white. Penny Lane, the leader of the Band-Aids, a group of young women who hung around rock bands at the time, is something of an enigma in the movie, shielding herself from the world with a pair of blue sunglasses and her suit of armor, a shearling coat. We learn more about her in the musical through songs such as Morocco, The Real World, and Lost in New York City. I love the idea of giving Penny Lane a little bit more backstory, more agency, Crow said. To me, Penny Lane is generally the smartest person in the room, so it's good to bring more of that to the story. One thing that I have really had to keep in mind is recognizing what it meant to have sexual autonomy in 1973, said Pfeiffer. Penny Lane was living in a world where a few months before our story takes place, Roe v. Wade was passed in the Supreme Court. What is really blowing my mind is that I'm playing a character that actually has more rights than half of the women in America right now. During early workshops for Almost Famous in New York in 2018, Crow sometimes ducked into a room to hide for a while because it stirred up so much stuff. The stage depictions of fights between his mother and his sister and his desperate attempt to keep the peace were raw and painful. But the more we did it, the more I would come back in the room and people would still be talking about it. I knew we were in the right direction when it started to have that beautiful, happy, sad pain, as well as the giddy love of the music and where the music takes you. But it wasn't always easy to kind of smile through sometimes. His mother kept tabs on the musical. She'd pop up on Zoom chats and say, "Don't do drugs." She gave her stamp of approval to Morocco and to Anika Larson. Crow has a photograph of Alice watching a video of Larson in rehearsal, and she's just sparkling. It's all in her eyes. When the actor originally playing William Miller, the adolescent Crow, left to do a TV show, the creative team cast Casey Likes, who as a high school junior from Arizona in 2019 was a finalist in the National High School Musical Theater Awards. Alice saw his performance tape and said, "Don't let Casey Likes get away. He's great." She was into the guerrilla warfare to the very end, Crow said, of the fight to keep a show going despite Broadway's long odds. During rehearsals in San Diego, Larson repeatedly asked Crow if she could meet Alice. You will," he told her. And then she heard Alice was in a coma as a result of cardiac arrest. Larson emailed Crow, "I don't know if I'm overstepping saying this, but could I just go visit her in the hospital? I know she's not awake, but they say people in comas can hear. We don't know." The next day, Crow drove Larson to the hospital. She introduced herself to Alice, held her hand, and sang one of her songs from the show. Alice Crow never saw Almost Famous at the Old Globe. She died on September 11, 2019, 2 days before the first preview. "A dramatic exit," said Crow. She'd never been shy about promoting her son. As her health began to fail in her later years, she'd made frequent visits to the Kaiser Permanente clinic. She'd ask the staff if they'd ever seen Almost Famous or Jerry Maguire. If they said yes, she'd tell them who her son was, call him up, and put them on the phone with him. Cameron, say hi to Warren. He's looking after me. She made so many friends that way, Crow recalled. Many people who knew Alice in San Diego came to see Almost Famous and would talk to Crow about her after the show. Everybody had a story. Sitting there night after night in the courtyard of the Old Globe, where his mother had dragged him to see As You Like It and Richard III, Crow had to laugh. So this is what the show has become, he said. The Alice Crow Jamboree. Sargent's Orders. Antoine Sargent has crashed the art world's most guarded gates, elevating dozens of black artists along the way. In the process, he's become the most buzzed about curator-gallerist on the scene, whether the establishment likes it or not, by Nate Freeman, with photos by Raphael Pavarotti, styled by Gary David Moore. Antoine Sargent is wearing high fashion clothing and is photographed for Vanity Fair in London on October 10th, 2022. On the Thursday after Labor Day, the Gagosian Gallery held a dinner at Alto Paradiso, an haute pasta spot in New York's Soho. Each year, that September evening is a rite of passage in the art world. The Chelsea galleries throw open their doors to the big fall shows. The public floods the blocks between 10th and 11th Avenues, and a select few get invited to dinners to celebrate it all, with cocktails flowing late into the evening. Of those galleries hosting dinners, Larry Gagosian's is the biggest, with 19 locations around the globe. That evening, the Houston-based artist Rick Lowe had debuted a suite of paintings at Gagosian in his first New York solo show, which had come on the heels of his inclusion in the Whitney Biennale earlier in the year. A line snaked down West 24th Street, and staff had to ensure passage for certain VIPs. Met director Max Hollein, Brooklyn Museum director Anne Pasternak, former cultural commissioner Tom Finkelpearl, the Ghanaian-British architect Sir David Ajay. The opening was set to close at 8 p.m., but by 8:30, the gallery was still thronged. Lowe, 61, finally arrived at Altro around 9, flanked by a dozen family members from Alabama, many of whom had never been to New York City. The restaurant was crowded with well-wishers. David Breslin, who would be announced as the new modern and contemporary curator at the Met in a few weeks, was chatting with the artist Cy Gavin. Gagosian COO Andrew Fabricant ate at a table stuffed with collectors. The artist Awal Erisku held court at another without ever removing his Marnie sunglasses. At the center of it all sat the show's curator, Antoine Sargent, who joined the gallery as a director at the start of 2021. Dressed in an outfit typical of his style, Gucci loafers with a Comme des Garçons jacket and Essentiel wool cap, Sargent occupied a seat reserved for Tyler Mitchell. The young photographer, whose own Sargent-organized show at Gagosian would open the following week in London. Mitchell was occupied for the evening at a dinner hosted by Matthew Blasi, creative director of the Italian fashion brand Bottega Veneta at the Strand Bookstore. "Believe me, if I didn't have to be here, I would be there. Can you believe it? A Bottega dinner at the Strand?" Sargent said, his eyes wide. Sargent is 34 years old and speaks with the authority of someone much older, while still exhibiting the excitability of a Gen Z TikTok star. His proclamations, which he can pose as outrageous provocations without indicating that his tongue is fully in his cheek, often end with a dramatic upswing in pitch. He's lithe, a former cross-country runner who still bikes hundreds of miles a week, and often coils his body as he begins a story, affecting a pounce when he hits his crescendo. At Altro, it was difficult for table mates to shift the subject, as Sargent opined, sipping a Negroni and then a second Negroni. "We discussed the sheer improbability of a dinner for a low show at Gagosian, the world's most sales-obsessed gallery. The artist practice has long been concerned with community organizing in Houston's Third Ward, about as far from the transactional temple of Gagosian's white cube as you could get. Yet Sargent had landed him. In the middle of the pandemic, I called Rick and I said, 'I heard you're making paintings,' he told the audience at the dinner in an all eyes on me toast that had been preceded by screams of Antoine. It was, in many ways, Sargent's night as much as the artist, a characterization the curator would strenuously disagree with, telling me in the hours leading up to the event that tonight is all about Rick. It's about Rick. Even so, as those pre-toast chants indicated, it was also undeniably Sargent's stage. In his two brief years at Gagosian, Sargent, who not so long ago was scraping together rent writing online, has become one of the more fawned over, buzzed about, and mystifying forces in the commercial gallery world. Sargent's trajectory from outsider to consummate insider has come amid a movement to bring black artists more into the programming at blue-chip galleries and top-flight institutions, where for centuries they've been marginalized or not shown at all. No one has done this more visibly than Sargent, becoming an art world micro-celebrity along the way with nearly 100,000 Instagram followers. Openings for shows he has curated have looked more like concerts, with young kids spilling out into the streets, generating waves of press and celebrity attention. When Jay-Z stopped by the gallery's London outpost during the Sargent-staged show Social Works 2, he was given a private tour by Sargent. As dessert arrived around midnight, Sargent showed little inclination that he would soon be heading back to the apartment in downtown Brooklyn he shares with a roommate. In a few days' time, he was set to fly to London to start installing the first Gagosian show for Mitchell, a major step in the photographer's continued ascendance. In one of our several interviews in early September, I asked Sargent about the place he now occupies among the tippy-top of the art market's highest elevation, and how exactly he reached it despite the odds stacked against him, and some forces still at play. I do understand that there was a space that I carved out, and I am sensitive to that, he said. If you would have asked Antoine what he would be doing when you're 33, I would have never said this. Never in my life would I have said this. For the last few years, many major institutions and blue-chip galleries have gone out of their way to correct the long-standing inequity of black artists in programming and collections. Between 2008 and 2018, just 2.37% of acquisitions at 30 prominent American museums were of work by black artists. Since then, the Baltimore Museum of Art and the Brooklyn Museum both deaccessioned works by white artists in order to have an endowment to acquire works by women and artists of color. Black artists, especially those who work in the field of figurative painting, have seen their prices skyrocket on the secondary market and have waiting lists for work on the primary market so long that even some of the world's top collectors can't access the work. Sargent is arguably the most recognizable face of this movement, a red carpet walking, social first curator slash dealer cloaked in custom Bodhi jackets and Issey Miyake pleats. Young, gifted, and black, a show of work from the collection of former media executive Bernard Lumpkin and his husband Carmine D. Bacuzzi that Sargent co-curated with Matt Wyckoff, has been touring for 3 years and is currently on view at the Minetti Schrem Museum of Art at UC Davis. Sargent organized Figures of Speech, the massive exhibition at the Brooklyn Museum of Work by the late Louis Vuitton designer Virgil Abloh that saw enterprising streetwear dealers buy out gift shop merch to flip at resale. This year, Sargent was asked, with Amy Ng, to put together a show of paintings by Barclay L. Hendricks at the Frick, the first time a black artist has had a show at the museum. In the fall, Sargent taught a photography course at Yale, a fact he casually dropped as he tracked down our Uber outside the Brooklyn Museum one afternoon this past summer after a walkthrough of the Abloh show, where he was gawked at by the designer's young devotees. As he's gone about his work, Sargent has overhauled the typical notion of an art curator as an egghead entombed within the institution. He is out on the town constantly. When he released the 2019 book, The New Black Vanguard, it came with a signing in Milan, hosted by Gucci, attended by Tyler, the creator, Arthur Jaffa, and Maurizio Cattelan. In March, following the Academy Awards, he attended Vanity Fair's after party, then moved on to Madonna and Guy Osiris bash, then went to Jay-Z and Beyoncé's at the Chateau Marmont, then straight to his Sunset Tower suite to retrieve his bag. He had to be back in New York for a dinner honoring Lowe's inclusion in the Whitney Biennale. Then he was off for a talk at Savannah College of Art and Design, alongside Mitchell, and then Venice for the Biennale, posting an Instagram pic in a pink silk three-piece Gucci suit. Antoine has always been stylish. He's always been in fashion. He's always been in music. He's always been in multiple circles. Me and Antoine, we used to say we're like the future and DJ Esco of the art world, Erescu told me, name-checking the trend-setting Atlanta rapper and his producer-manager. The comparison of Sargent, who has worked to carve out his own lane in his own style and been handsomely rewarded as the industry caught up, was apt. For years, Sargent was a freelance critic, writing for the New York Times and the New Yorker. He has reached his lofty curatorial perch at the world's most powerful commercial gallery without the usual MFAs and PhDs, and without climbing the ladder from front desk to assistant, to dealer, to director. To many in art's old guard, this deems him unworthy. That this concerns the most air-kissed echelons of the art world, few inhabitants would even voice their criticisms for attribution, but suffice it to say Sargent has his haters, and they typically have two or three lines of complaint. From speaking to a number of arts professionals, many think it's a bit much to proclaim him a genius for finding market-friendly black artists and selling their work to loyal Gagosian clients under the aegis of black social practice, especially if he's making money doing so. Some scholars of photo-based work, meanwhile, have knocked his choice of artist, saying he tended to elevate his friends, who worked mostly as, the horror, fashion photographers. As for the crowds he tends to attract to his openings, well, some find it distracting at best, PR at the worst, as if pursuing populism was the equivalent of the blue-chip galleries turning into the Museum of Ice Cream. Or some say that Sargent is too quick to appear on a red carpet or front row at a fashion show to be treated like a serious curator. As one source put it to me, Antoine Sargent was on Gossip Girl. Can you ever imagine Harold Seizman on MASH? Then there are the literal critics. In a splashy but quietly devastating review, the Times venerable Holland Cotter wrote, "Gagosian is, of course, deeply inside that world and deeply conventional in every way. In fact, the single most surprising thing about social works is finding it there at all." The small but influential Manhattan Art Review panned the same show hard. At root, the problem is that there's a persistent assumption that the work has meaning by virtue of cultural associations that stand outside of the artwork's own qualities, the site's much-feared author, Sean Tattle, wrote. Sargent said he's aware of the critiques, if indifferent. "Art Forum has never reviewed or written about anything I've ever done, ever," he told me. "I've been doing this for 10 years, and I've been doing this at a scale that no one has been doing. So I think there might be some hateration over there. You get attention, people hate. But no one has done it to my face." In a statement, Art Forum editor-in-chief David Velasco said, "Antoine Sargent's writings and exhibitions have been noted in various parts of the magazine. The reviews section is small, and there are hundreds of shows each month competing for attention. We miss many worthy exhibitions all the time." Nor has it slowed his ascent. After his multi-show takeover of Gagosian's gallery at Park Avenue and 75th Street, he'll stage an edition of social works at the gallery's Beverly Hills space, followed by two solo shows in Los Angeles, another complete takeover. Antoine is a Renaissance man, what the consultants call an ambidextrous leader. And what I mean by that is he is truly interdisciplinary, says Darren Walker, president of the Ford Foundation, the $16 billion art and social justice fund. And I think he's a great curator. He's a beautiful writer. He is a capitalist. All of those things are part of his identity, and he wears it with pride. Until somewhat recently, the term curator referred pretty exclusively to a person who selected artworks for an exhibition, wrote a text justifying the choices with intellectual rigor, and picked where they would go in the space. Curators worked for museums rather than galleries. As curators tended not to want to involve themselves in the messiness of selling art. That membrane has grown more porous in recent years, however. Sargent, who comfortably straddles the institutional and commercial realms, was already an outlier. But there's more to it. I spoke with Hans Ulrich Obrist, the perpetually in motion artistic director of the Serpentine Galleries in London, who's the first hit when you Google world's most famous curator. He considers Sargent a peer. Both sides learn from each other, you know, Obrist said. Being between disciplines, making contributions to different disciplines, community, and practice is something we can see very strongly in a younger generation of artists. But I think Antoine's work as a curator also reflects that. To Obrist's point, as the audience for contemporary art has grown in recent years, thanks to the broader exposure brought by social media, Sargent's role as a curator of color, with the demeanor of an outsider but the savvy of an insider, has become incredibly valuable. Antoine is tapped into a community, a very broad community. I came out of the 80s, and that wasn't the case. It was a very white art world back then, says Pasternak, the Brooklyn Museum director, who, after years of conversation, gave Ablo a show of his conceptual artwork. She recalled the Low opening in September. I've been friends with Rick for almost 30 years, and I was amazed by the diversity on the streets in Chelsea, she went on. 5 years ago, that's not something you would have seen. When I spoke to Walker, he called Sargent the ultimate brilliant code switcher. He's able to bridge Park Avenue and Bushwick, right? Walker says. He's able to connect the East Side with East New York, right? What Antoine is doing is disrupting the canon of art history, particularly modern and contemporary art history, because he's redefining what is excellent and challenging us to think more broadly about what constitutes excellence in great art and who produces it. Sargent was born in Chicago and raised with his three siblings by his mother, Rishuna Chu, in public housing in the since-demolished Cabrini Green homes. Chu, who worked as a manager at a Walgreens, made sure that her son had whatever he needed, whatever piqued his interest. My mother worked every day to give us the world, and in that way it was just so good, because we were never really aware of money, Sargent said. We were lunching downtown at Dimes. It was the end of July, when most collectors are out of pocket on yachts in Capri or shacked up in Aspen Mountain homes. Sargent worked as he chatted, selling a Mitchell work via text and talking to Gagosian Asia director Nick Simunovich about a private collection in China, trying to vet them before offering them a low. Growing up, Sargent had an early interest in politics, which led him to Mather, a public school 30 minutes from home, where he was part of a special law program. He interned for judges, volunteered for Barack Obama's U.S. Senate campaign, competed on the mock trial team, and ran track and cross country. Eventually, he started dabbling in the city's cultural and nightlife offerings, mostly in Boys Town, Chicago's district of gay clubs. At one restaurant, Sargent would spend hours talking with artists and poets. He also hung out with friends such as painter Jeanette Hayes and Chancellor Bennett, the teenage son of an Obama staffer who would later become Chance the Rapper. Sargent went to Georgetown to study at the School of Foreign Service and interned for Hillary Clinton. Politics began to wear on him, and he found a post-college gig with Teach for America at a school in East New York, Brooklyn. A college buddy found him a room in an apartment with Gia Faye, a young Guggenheim staffer. Sargent arrived at Faye's apartment with all his earthly belongings one day, much to her surprise. Her outgoing roommate announced Sargent would be taking over his lease on his way out the door. He was a kindergarten teacher, so I was like, okay, maybe this is okay. He's not going to be crazy, Faye said. They still lived together. At the time, Faye was building the Guggenheim's then non-existent social media presence. It was 2012. Faye had just started to realize Instagram's potential, how it could make the treasures in private collections peeing around the world on phone screens. Faye, who recalled Sargent studying for the LSAT nonstop at the time, offered her new roommate entry to the art world via plus ones, to gallery dinners and fashion parties. They would bike around to shows as Faye gathered a steady stream of content for her feeds. Sargent often featured in the shots and eventually started his own account. It would be me at school during the day, 7 to 4, then bolting out to a fashion shoot or bolting out to catch plane, Sargent said. Thank God that the school was so close to JFK. Sargent met his obligation at Teach for America in May 2013 and started focusing on writing, catching bylines where he could. Later that year, for the Huffington Post, he wrote a scathing and unpaid take on a controversial segment in which CNN anchor Don Lemon had given condescending advice to young black men. The post went viral. Lemon now collects work by black contemporary artists and is acquaintances with Sargent. Over the summer, they saw each other at Darren Walker's apartment at a party honoring AJ. Then came a gig at BuzzFeed, where Sargent's byline was attached to pop culture listicles and other content that's been largely shunted to the dustbin of internet history. Sample Sargent headline, 27 times Olivia Pope looked so ridiculously perfect and beautiful and perfect. But Sargent really wanted to write about art, primarily about young artists of color. He published a few items on Vice at $150 a pop. He was covering his $750 per month rent, but it was barely enough. I also am grateful that I was even given the work, because you talk to a lot of black writers and it was like they're not even just being commissioned, he said. And among the legacy publications, the writerly contingent itself was almost exclusively white, something that surprised Sargent as he entered the field. I remember the day I had to disclose to him that Holland Cotter from the New York Times wasn't black, Faye said. He looked shocked. In 2014, the arts nonprofit Creative Time unveiled a new work by Kara Walker at the former Domino Sugar Factory on the Williamsburg waterfront. The 35-foot sphinx-like sculpture became one of the most talked-about works of the decade. Walker had been a touchstone for Sargent since he was an undergraduate, and he pitched an interview to The New Yorker, which the magazine ultimately declined. Staff writer Hilton Alls reviewed the show. The rejection of a potential assignment is a fairly commonplace occurrence in the ever-capricious digital media economy, but the episode loomed large to a 20-something Sargent. First time I met Hilton at a dinner, I was like, I just want you to know, I was 23, and I was trying to do my first story at The New Yorker. And it didn't break my spirit, but it kind of did, Sargent recalled. Ask about the exchange, Al said. I'm so sorry that Antoine believes that any of this is true. He eventually got it accepted at Complex, and the act of interviewing a personal hero at her moment of greatest cultural crossover sparked Sargent's ambitions. He thought that his writing could both better inform the public about new black artists and clarify the practice of those already in the mainstream. He'd occasionally noticed collectors who installed works by black artists in insensitive ways. He recalled once visiting the house of a white collector. I turned a corner, and I'm seeing all these Kara Walker effing silhouettes, Sargent said. Fine, fair, whatever, but I also am just like, what? A waitress brought over our food. Why do you have 20 of these? Can you tell me why you have 20 of these? Around the time of the Walker show, Sargent pivoted his writing almost exclusively to art. He contributed catalog essays for gallery shows, which gave way to some early curatorial work. For the photography nonprofit Aperture, he put together the book The New Black Vanguard, which spawned several reprintings and a world touring show. After that, Lumpkin, whose Tribeca apartment has long been a site of cultural salons, approached him about a monograph for his collection. Lumpkin and his husband, Bokusi, had been building a collection of black artists, including Henry Taylor, Rashid Johnson, and Jordan Castile. When Concordia College asked Lumpkin and Bokusi to stage a show of works from the collection, they asked Sargent to organize the exhibit with their collection manager, Matt Wyckoff. Around the same time, Sargent helped put together a book documenting the collection. The market for black contemporary artists had been building, and the show was impeccably timed. In May 2018, Sean Combs bought Kerry James Marshall's Pastimes for $21.1 million, smashing the record price for a living black artist. The excitement trickled down to the primary market. New works by Mark Bradford, the black abstract painter who represented the U.S. at the Venice Biennale in 2017, were selling for as much as $5 million. By the time the Lumpkin Show began traveling the country under Sargent's direction in February 2020, the critical establishment was starting to more regularly cover black artists, but often in a way that unsettled Sargent. The praise, as he saw it, now seemed too effusive. Or, as Sargent said, it's all these white critics lying because they don't want to be racist about how great black art is. All the shows are great? Holding the all for what seemed like a minute. All of them? All of them? I'm sorry. You called this shit awful 7 years ago because I read your review. Now you're praising it. Someone inevitably, the gallery saw the value in having on staff someone like Sargent to not just write about black artists, but bring them into the fold of the gallery. A few had already approached him when he landed on the radar of Andrew Fabricant, who joined Gagosian in 2018 as COO, seen by many as the successor to the 77-year-old dealer king. The first time I met Antoine, I could just see the star power, Fabricant says. I mean, the guy is indefatigable. He's got enormous charm. He's got incredible chops. He's got his relationships with artists. He's got relationships with the fashion world. Not only with the creative side, there's art handlers. There's the whole logistical side of what we do. That is unique in my experience at Gagosian, which in the past was not the warmest or fuzziest place to work. Eventually, he was introduced to the gallery's founder, who got his start by selling posters on the street in Westwood Village in the mid-1970s and now does $1 billion a year in sales. They agreed to a partnership where Sargent would put together a group show, and the names on the list were mostly artists the gallery kingpin had never heard of. The art world kind of realized that the situation's been really lopsided for a long time, and African-American, black artists, what have you, have been sort of kept out of the game, Gagosian told me in October. And so my gallery, like a lot of galleries, has been thinking about diversity. But what I've come to realize is these are some incredibly innovative and fresh artists. Antoine hasn't brought me any artists to look at that I said, oh, geez, why do you think this is interesting? This is ugh, I can't. It's usually just the opposite. For his Gagosian debut, Sargent proposed something much more ambitious than his programming to that point. Social Works, a group show of black artists involved in performance and installation-based practices that involve some aspect of community organizing. Ajay made a 60-ton freestanding sculpture, his first. Linda Good Bryant installed a fully operational urban farm with the produce bagged and pinned on the walls. The Astor Gates' A Song for Frankie, 2017 to 2021, featured 5,000 records from the archives of legendary Chicago house pioneer Frankie Knuckles, which blasted for the run of the show. And someone had to sell everything. Curators have historically stayed on the institutional side, occasionally doing one-off work for galleries. And the idea of a curator-dealer is a relatively new phenomenon. It came pretty easy to Sargent. Most of these artists he's bringing in, there's a built-in clientele and a list of people who want these things. It's not rocket science, Fabrikant says, but he took to it quite rapidly, and he enjoys it, not only for the interaction, but for the money. Gagosian sees it as a natural extension for Sargent. I wouldn't call him a salesman or an art dealer. Sargent won't reveal his salary or commission, even if the money is great, much better than $150 a pop for a Vice story. Certainly, there are those who roll their eyes at Sargent curating and earning commission. But, Sargent said, the impact of having shows that feature and sell black artists within a commercial gallery is a crucial element of his ambition as a person of color in a power position supporting artists of color. Not every arts institution shares this goal. Doing these shows and letting esteemed curators or black curators come and do shows at your galleries, and there are no works for sale, bro, that's expensive PR, he said. It's actually disrespectful to everybody involved. We're not asking for anything special. We're just asking for the effing opportunity to compete. And I think that was the thing that informed my decision to join the gallery. Because they gave me a real opportunity to compete, and you can see what I've done with it. And that's the only thing. It doesn't need to be like we're correcting our da-da-da, F all that. We're living in this country. We know what it is. Give us the opportunity to compete. On the first Thursday of October, a few days before the start of the Frieze Art Fair in London, Gagosian opened it for its first show with Tyler Mitchell at its Mayfair space on Davis Street. Mitchell, 27, first came to widespread acclaim for his editorial work for Vogue and Vanity Fair, and the opening was scheduled for September in the heart of London Fashion Week, but Queen Elizabeth's death had caused the gallery to delay. The show was already a risk, an artist's first show at the gallery, a photography show in an art market that is crazy for painting, etc. Now it had to compete with the madness of an international art fair. I ran into Mitchell, walking through Mayfair on the way to the show, and as we approached, I saw a series of diptych photos visible through the window. Unlike most of Gagosian's other galleries, this one has floor-to-ceiling windows to display the bulk of the show to the public, with the lights kept on until midnight. The works marked a major breakthrough for Mitchell. They draw on his history of celebrity photography, but turn his lens to young men and women to present a kind of utopian vision of American blackness. There's an office through an unmarked false wall at the back of the gallery, and I opened it to see Sargent sitting at the desk. He wore a brown Burberry suit, it's British, honey, and a shirt by Grace Wales Bonner, the London-based designer and artist who showed in Social Works too in London. Despite having been at his friend Madonna's Marylebone mansion until 5 in the morning, oh my God, she has Frida Kahlo and Picasso, and what's that guy we represent who does the women with the big boobs? Oh, John Curran. He did not seem the least bit tired. The people are rolling through, he said, fixing his hat on his head 2 minutes after the opening began. In came Amy Sherald, the artist who painted Michelle Obama's portrait, and now has new work selling for as much as $3.6 million. There was Lynette Yadomboke, whose paintings have sold for more than $1.95 million at auction, chatting with fellow British artist Anthea Hamilton. From Los Angeles came rising star Lauren Halsey, and also present was Alvaro Barrington, the painter who shows with London's Sadie Coles HQ, and the Viennese-born London dealer Thaddeus Ropak. Bonner came by, as did fellow fashion designer Ireland's Simone Rojas, as did Edward Enninful, the editor of British Vogue. Anna Wintour had a private tour from Mitchell the day before. Christiane Amanpour was there, but so were hundreds of young people of color, along with bankers and Savile Row fits, there to get a peek at the commotion on their way home from the pubs. At 7:40, a sales assistant burst out of the gallery and into the street and went up to Sargent's assistant with word the show had sold out. Moments later, Sargent emerged from the back office where he had been, closing deals he had spent months setting up. "It's been all sold, even the editions, and you know how effing hard it is to sell photo," he said, "and I sold 2/3 of it myself. So if there was any question about whether I can sell..." With the gallery still crowded, Sargent, Mitchell, and more VIPs made their way to a private room at Maison Estelle, a Mayfair private club chosen, perhaps, because it has a no-pictures policy that requires guests to put stickers over their phone's lenses. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selection by Mark Hoffman.